KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sandpoint, K201DA, 88.1.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I'm currently on the Madeleine, a humanitarian aid ship carrying humanitarian aid into Gaza and to challenge the Israeli siege on Gaza and to stand in solidarity with the Palestinians.
Swedish activist Greta Thunberg is attempting to sail to Gaza on a humanitarian aid boat organized by the Freedom Flotilla Coalition. She'll join us from the boat. But first, to Gaza.
These are death traps. These are death traps. Our people are more aware than that. We will not walk into death traps.
The head of the Red Cross is saying Gaza has become worse than hell on earth, as Israeli attacks have killed nearly 100 Palestinians over the past 24 hours. The shadowy new U.S.-Israeli aid operation is shut down for a day after over 100 Palestinians were shot dead trying to get aid. We'll speak to an Oxfam representative in Gaza. Then, as Republican lawmakers move to ban states from regulating artificial intelligence, we'll speak to the journalist Karen Howe, author of the new book Empire of AI, Dreams and Nightmares in Sam Altman's Open AI. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Officials in Gaza say Israeli attacks over the past day have killed at least 95 Palestinians and injured 440 others. Among the dead are 18 people, including children, killed when Israel bombed a school housing displaced Palestinians in Khan Yunis. The airstrike came hours after Israeli planes dropped leaflets ordering people in Khan Yunis to leave their homes and head west.
Honestly, there isn't a single centimeter in the Gaza Strip that's truly safe. But some areas are relatively safer than others. The Israelis call it a safe zone, but in reality, it's not. Every day or two, you see them hitting a tent here or a house there, even a person in a car. There's no safe place in this country.
Separately, an Israeli strike hit the roof of an administrative building of the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital in Deir al-Balah, setting off fear and confusion among medical staff and patients. Meanwhile, the U.S. and Israeli-backed private organization Gaza Humanitarian Foundation said it's suspending aid distribution for a day to address security concerns. Israel's military warned Palestinians that roads leading to the aid distribution centers will be considered combat zones. This comes after 3 days of attacks on Palestinians at aid sites that killed 102 people and left nearly 500 others wounded. The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights has called for a prompt and impartial investigation into each of the attacks, which he says could constitute a grave breach of international law and a war crime. This is a spokesperson for the UN Human Rights Chief.
The willful impediment of access to food and other life-sustaining relief supplies for civilians may constitute a war crime. The threat of starvation, together with 20 months of killing of civilians and destruction on a massive scale, repeated forced displacements, intolerable, dehumanizing rhetoric and threats by Israel's leadership to empty the strip of its population also constitute elements of the most serious crimes under international law.
Syrian officials have condemned Israeli airstrikes on the Syrian province of Deraa, which they say caused heavy human and material losses. Israel launched the strikes Tuesday after officials said they tracked two projectiles fired from Syria into open ground in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. After the fall of Bashar al-Assad in December, Israel waged a months-long campaign of airstrikes that destroyed much of Syria's military infrastructure. South Korea's elected liberal opposition candidate Lee Jae-myung as president in a snap election. Speaking to supporters outside the National Assembly in Seoul, President Lee promised to strengthen South Korea's democracy after his predecessor, Yoon Suk-yeol, briefly and unsuccessfully declared martial law.
I will fulfill the first mission that people have entrusted to me, which is to overcome the insurrection and make sure that there will be no military coup that threatens the people with the weapons entrusted by them. I will look for dialogue and communication between South and North Korea and find a way to coexist and cooperate to find a path to shared prosperity.
In Sudan, at least five humanitarian aid workers were killed in a deadly overnight ambush on a United Nations food delivery convoy Tuesday in Darfur. The 15-truck food aid convoy was transporting critical supplies from Port Sudan to North Darfur when it was attacked by unknown assailants, injuring several others. The World Food Program and others condemned the attack, in which trucks were burned, as a violation of humanitarian law and urged an investigation, as the convoy's route had been shared in advance with the Sudanese army and rapid support forces. This comes as Sudan is facing worsening famine, exacerbated by the sudden suspension of U.S. aid by the Trump administration, which experts warn could prompt one of the deadliest hunger crises in the last half a century.
Unprecedented crisis that we are facing. This is a crisis of humanity. Without a significant increase in funding, life-saving assistance cannot be delivered at the scale and at the speed that is required.
More than 2 years of war in Sudan has created what international groups describe as the world's largest displacement and hunger crisis, with an estimated 4 million people forced to flee Sudan since 2023, according to the UN. This all comes as Sudanese officials have reported at least another 70 deaths in recent days due to cholera, with hundreds of new infections, most of them in the state of Khartoum. The region's water treatment stations have been damaged due to electricity outages caused by strikes, forcing local residents to turn to unsafe water sources. Aid workers say corpses of people killed in attacks between Sudanese soldiers and RSF fighters have been left to rot next to the Nile River, partially triggering the quick spread of cholera. Aid groups fear South Sudan is on the brink of another war, as dozens of civilians, including children, have been killed or severely injured in recent weeks in violent clashes between South Sudan's army and militia groups across the country. Survivors describe airstrikes and bombings on local communities, including while people are sleeping. Doctors say the ongoing fighting has made it difficult to transport severely injured patients to receive urgent medical care. Tensions between South Sudan's government and opposition groups have been rising since March. This comes as the Trump administration's legal fight to transfer immigrants from the U.S. to South Sudan has reached the U.S. Supreme Court. President Trump has formally asked Congress to rescind $8.3 billion in previously enacted funding for foreign assistance from USAID and the African Development Foundation. The request seeks to make permanent the cuts to foreign aid already imposed by Elon Musk's so-called Department of Government Efficiency. Oxfam America warns those cuts could cause 23 million children to lose access to education, while up to 95 million people would lose access to basic health care, potentially leading to over 3 million preventable deaths per year. Meanwhile, Trump is pressing Senate Republicans to approve the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill Act, a sprawling bill to fund tax breaks for the wealthy by gutting social programs like SNAP, Medicare, and Medicaid. Senate holdouts include Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who said he's not open to supporting a $5 trillion increase in the national debt ceiling. On Tuesday, Republican holdouts got the support of Elon Musk, who wrote on X, quote, "I'm sorry, but I just can't stand it anymore. This massive, outrageous, pork-filled congressional spending bill is a disgusting abomination. Shame on those who voted for it. You know you did wrong. You know it," Elon Musk wrote. The Trump administration has rescinded Biden-era protections for pregnant people in need of emergency abortions. The guidance under the Federal Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act directs hospitals and states with abortion bans to provide the life-saving care when pregnant patients are experiencing a medical crisis. The ACLU said in a statement, quote, "The Trump administration cannot simply erase four decades of law protecting patients' lives with the stroke of a pen. Regardless of where they live, pregnant patients have a right to emergency abortion care that'll save their health or lives, unquote. Federal immigration authorities have detained the wife and five children of the suspect accused of using a makeshift flamethrower and another incendiary device to attack a crowd of people taking part in a weekly walk to honor Israeli hostages in Gaza. Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem said Tuesday they face expedited deportation after the Trump administration revoked their visas. Noem also said DHS is investigating whether the family knew of the attack or provided any support. Federal prisons must keep providing gender-affirming hormone care and protections to transgender people after a federal judge Tuesday issued a preliminary injunction blocking one of Trump's anti-trans executive orders. The ACLU welcomed the critical ruling, saying in a statement, quote, "This administration's cruelty towards transgender people disregards their rights under the Constitution. The denial of medically necessary health care, including gender-affirming health care, to people in prison is a violation of their fundamental constitutional rights," unquote. As June marks LGBTQ Pride Month, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth is planning to strip the name of the legendary gay rights activist Harvey Milk from a Navy ship honoring him. Harvey Milk was one of the first openly gay politicians in the United States. He was assassinated in 1978, a year after winning election to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors, gunned down along with San Francisco Mayor George Moscone by a former city supervisor. Hegseth is also reportedly planning to expand the purge of names to include other prominent civil rights figures such as abolitionist Sojourner Truth, Medgar Evers, and labor leader Cesar Chavez. The White House is seeking to shut down the Chemical Safety and Hazard Investigation Board, according to White House budget documents released Friday. Since it was founded in 1998, the independent agency has led investigations into major disasters, including fatal explosion of ammonium nitrate fertilizer in West Texas in 2013 and the 2010 Deepwater Horizon oil well blowout in the Gulf of Mexico. And the city of Tulsa has announced reparations for the 1921 Tulsa Race Massacre, when white rioters murdered an estimated 300 black residents of the city's Greenwood neighborhood known as Black Wall Street, looting and destroying homes and businesses. A Justice Department report in January concluded the massacre was a coordinated military-style attack. Despite that, no one was ever convicted or held criminally accountable. On Sunday, Tulsa Mayor Monroe Nichols announced a $105 million reparations package during a ceremony commemorating the first ever official Tulsa Race Massacre Observance Day.
This is not the age-old battle of black versus white, or the more contemporary battle of blue versus red. This is about putting those petty divisions and outdated thinking behind us as we press on together. This effort is about reconciliation. It is about repair. It's about renewal, and it's about righteousness.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman in New York, joined by Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Officials in Gaza say Israeli attacks over the past day have killed at least 95 Palestinians and injured 440 others. At least 18 of the dead are in Khan Yunis following an Israeli airstrike on a school sheltering displaced Palestinians. Meanwhile, the new shadowy U.S.-Israeli-backed aid operation has suspended aid distribution for a day to address what it called, quote, renovation, reorganization, and efficiency improvement work, unquote. This comes after Palestinian officials accused Israel repeatedly attacking Palestinians headed to the aid sites. The attacks killed 102 people, left nearly 500 others wounded. The dead included a mother named Rim Zaidan, who was shot while waiting for aid in Western Rafah. On Tuesday, her children and other mourners gathered for her funeral procession at Khan Yunis. This is Rim Zaidan's 16-year-old daughter, Tahrir.
In the highest paradise, Mom, we'll see her in the highest paradise, God willing. She put on her abaya and veil, took a sack of flour and a bag with her, hoping to fill them with canned food. For 5 days, she's been going for nothing.
And this is Reem Zeidan's 15-year-old son, Ahmed, describing how his mother was fatally shot while trying to get aid.
We haven't eaten in 2 months. Everything has been under siege. Of course we were going to go get aid. Today my mother was telling my brother, lean over, lower your head, do what I'm doing. My brother turned his head, then a bullet went into her head.
We go now to Gaza City, where we're joined by Mahmoud Asaka, the Oxfam Food Security and Livelihoods Coordinator in Gaza. Welcome back to Democracy Now! In a moment, we're going to be going to the ship that's trying to make its way to challenge Israel's blockade of Gaza. We'll be speaking with the Swedish activist Greta Thunberg. But can you, Mahmoud, tell us what's happening on the ground and the latest with this closing of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation set up by Israel, backed by the U.S., that took over three or four sites that built them instead of the 400 that were on the ground around Gaza?
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me again. In fact, the situation on the ground is extremely chaotic. And it's as we have warned before about this, especially with this aid distribution mechanism. In fact, what is happening in this new militarized distribution points, it's more about the humiliation and the control of the people. We are seeing the people, thousands of people are standing from the early hours in the morning to secure something to their starving children. And in such cases, it's rare even to get actually the supplies. And now they are facing the issue of returning home alive. So we are considering these points as a death traps, and we are seeing shooting of starving people near to these sites, especially what's happened in Rafah, as per your report in this. It's horrifying, and many people have lost their lives in these sites. So these sites are controlled by private actors. It's located in a military zones, in a military conflict areas. So they didn't even consider any things related to the human beings and dignity. And what was expected to happen from these sites is contradicts again, and nothing achieved in terms of addressing the high and the overwhelming needs of the people here in Gaza.
And Mahmoud, the other organizations, aid organizations that have been on the ground since this conflict began, has the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation had any kind of communication or coordination with the existing groups?
No. You know, our position from the first that we were against such a mechanism because we have the system in place. We have the system of the UN and the international NGOs that exist in place and which has proven its effectiveness since the 19 months, and even the improvement was noticed during the ceasefire period, where we able to reach more and more vulnerable people. And this is vulnerable people who are not accessing even this the new GHO distribution points. And we have this multi-sectoral assistance. What we are having now in this distribution points is just food, and the people in need for a multi-sectoral assistance that we were trying to provide. This including the medical supplies, the clean water, shelter materials, and all these things. And these things are now ignored within this mechanisms. And we are trying all the time to abide to the international humanitarian law and preserving the dignity of those people, which is this mechanism or strips the people of dignity. And this is why we are seeing all this humiliation of the people. In summary, this mechanism is dehumanizing the people. And it's really dangerous. People are losing their lives there. And it's ineffective in reaching the people, especially the vulnerable people. And we have our mechanism in place and active. So there is no need even for this mechanism at all.
And is Israel allowing any supplies in for the existing mechanism of aid groups in Gaza?
Yeah, as you know, after the international community pressure on Israel, after 12 weeks of a full blockade, in the 21st of March, they allowed a trickle of aid to come in. But it still have this over control on this aid that are coming. And it's a very limited quantities that are coming. And even it's limited for food supplies and some nutrition items where the need is much more than this. In average, what we are receiving in Gaza Strip right now in this mechanism is around 50 trucks, 60 trucks, or even less more. But it's nothing compared to what we should have, and it's not addressing the huge needs of the people here in Gaza Strip. So even with those mechanisms, we are still seeing this happening, and the people are starving. And this is the question, that where is the problem? The problem is with this mechanism, that it's not efficient or effective. We need to have a smooth supply of the aid in order to be able to provide the services. And we succeeded in doing so in a previous period of time.
Mahmoud, the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, has reported that the number of Gaza's children killed or injured by Israel since October 2023 has surpassed 50,000. In a statement, UNICEF wrote, "How many more dead girls and boys will it take? What level of horror must be live streamed before the international community fully steps up, uses its influence, and takes bold, decisive action to force the end of this ruthless killing of children?" As we speak, people in London are forming a red line. They are holding red banners fully around the British Parliament, while Britain and France and Canada have said they're going to crack down on relations with Israel. These people are demanding that they stop arming Israel. Can you talk about what's happening with the children on the ground at this point?
Yeah, the situation is deteriorating over time, especially with the vulnerable groups, including the children. You know, and according to the last food security and the nutrition report, that we are expecting more worsening in the health of children who are more affected by this shortages of all supplies in the Gaza Strip. And this is increasing because we are seeing more displacement orders are in place, more intensifying of the military operations, and more displacement for the people to a crowded people, so to a crowded places. So we are seeing the outbreak of diseases, and the health public health is deteriorating, and the health sector is collapsing. So we are expecting worse for the vulnerable groups, including the children. So this is why we have to save lives. We must go back to our work, reopening all the crossings and lift the movement and a few restrictions for the people. And what we are seeing around the world nowadays, it's really important and should be continued in order to hold Israel accountable to their what they are doing right now, and also to reach this permanent ceasefire nowadays. We are talking about permanent ceasefire. We do not need a pause to have such a few days and return back to the same area. We need a permanent ceasefire so the people can breathe again, and at least to be able to recover from all these things that they are encountering and facing right now.
Mahmoud Alsaka, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Oxfam's Food Security and Livelihoods Coordinator, speaking to us from Gaza. When we come back, we go to the high seas, to Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, who's attempting to sail to Gaza with about a dozen other people on a humanitarian aid boat organized by the Freedom Flotilla. She'll join us from the boat, back in 30 seconds.
Voy a tomar el viento a mi favor. Y a navegar hacia un viaje mejor. Y a contemplar la infinidad del sol. Con la certeza de un trato mejor. Fiel a tus valores debes ir. Caminar por esa senda y resistir. Para que tú conquistes ese buen vivir. que aunque lo tengan todo, no te tiene a ti. Que los peces gordos no pueden volar. Soy otra madre que duermo poco pero sueña mucho, que aprende más de sus hijos que del mundo adulto. Cuando grande quiero ser un niño.
Big Fish Can't Fly by Anna Tijoux in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As Gaza faces more than 3 months of a near-total Israeli blockade, activists are heading there now on a ship to deliver humanitarian aid. The boat is called the Madeleine, named after Gaza's first fisherwoman, who ran her father's fishing business after he was injured in a 2009 Israeli attack. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition initially planned to sail from Malta last month, but their ship was damaged after it was bombed by drones in international waters. At Sunday's launch of the Madeleine from the Italian port of Catania, actor Liam Cunningham, known for his role in the series Game of Thrones, spoke out in support of the effort.
My name is Liam. I'm from Ireland. The reason I'm here, as far as I'm concerned, the heart and soul of humanity is in Gaza. For me, this attack, this genocide, is not just on Palestinians, it is on the whole human race. These wonderful, brave people who are setting off on this boat are heroes. And also the people of Gaza, for the last 600 days, are heroes. They are, in my mind, they will always be heroes.
A group of 12 activists are carrying the aid for Gaza, including the Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, who'll join us from the Madeleine ship in a minute. She spoke Sunday at the launch.
A month after our latest attempt to go on with this mission, the boat was bombed twice. All evidence suggests Israel. And we are doing this because we have to keep our promise to the Palestinians to do everything in our power to protest against the genocide and to try to open up a humanitarian corridor.
Since setting sail, passengers on the flotilla have faced many threats, including from U.S. Senator Lindsey Graham, who wrote on X, quote, "Hope Greta and her friends can swim," unquote. The Gaza Freedom Flotilla has also been shadowed by at least one military helicopter and have reported drones circulating the ship. This is Thiago Avila.
Hello, everyone. This is a new alert. We can clearly see a drone right now to our left. It's gaining on us a little bit. Please share this alert. Second alert of the night. The third day of our journey to Gaza to break the siege and create a people's humanitarian corridor on board the Madeleine. Please share our location. We'll be sending the exact coordinates.
In 2010, Israel conducted a deadly raid on another Gaza-bound aid ship, the Mavi Marmara. Israeli commandos stormed the boat in international waters, killing 9 people. A 10th died after 4 years in a coma. For more, we're joined from the international waters by Greta Thunberg, the internationally renowned Swedish climate activist known for inspiring the global youth climate strike. In 2019, she received the Right Livelihood Award. She's also been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. Greta is speaking to us aboard the Gaza Freedom Flotilla's vessel Madeleine, which is on this voyage from Sicily to Gaza, again carrying life-saving aid in an attempt to break Israel's siege of the Gaza Strip. Greta, it's really something to see you on that ship right now. Can you tell us why you're taking this journey, extremely dangerous, and how you're planning to challenge the Israeli blockade?
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. Yeah, as you said, we are doing this mission following 1 month after our last attempt, boat Conscience was bombed and disabled. So that's why we are trying again, because we cannot afford to give up. There is simply too much at stake. And in times of injustice, as we are seeing now, the genocide and blockade happening, we have to do everything we can to demand an end to these atrocities and war crimes committed by Israel. And for me personally,
I happen to have a platform for some reason, and then it is my moral obligation to use that platform. And if my presence on this boat can make a difference, if that can show in any way that the world has not forgotten about Palestine, and to try once again to attempt to break the siege and open up a humanitarian corridor and deliver the extremely needed humanitarian aid, then that is a risk I'm willing to take. And it's something that we just simply have to do. We cannot just sit around and do nothing and watch this live stream genocide unfold in front of our very eyes. So we are doing this because we are human beings who care about justice. And when our complicit governments fail to step up, it falls on us, unfortunately, to do so.
And Greta, could you talk about how you see the issue of Palestinian freedom connecting to or intersecting with the issue that you're best known for, which is climate change activism?
Yeah, for me, there's no way of distinguishing the two. We cannot have climate justice without social justice. The reason why I am a climate activist is not because I want to protect trees. I'm a climate activist because I care about human and planetary well-being, and those are extremely interlinked. For example, when we see the genocide in Gaza, of course, there are some very obvious links that ecocide, environmental destruction, is a very common method used in war and to oppress people. But also, it should be much simpler than that. No matter what the cause of the suffering is, whether that is CO2, whether that is bombs, whether that is state repression or other forms of violence, we have to stand up against that source of suffering. If we pretend to care about the environment, if we pretend to care about the climate and our children's future without seeing and acknowledging and fighting against the suffering of all marginalized people today, then that is an extremely racist approach to justice, and that excludes the majority of the world's population.
And how? What is the mood aboard the ship? You have participants from Brazil, France, Germany, Spain, and you yourself are Swedish. What's the mood there?
The mood on board the ship is, I would say, that our spirits are very high and we are very determined to continue. So far, we have won over one of the major predicted obstacles, which is to be stuck in port due to the bureaucratic warfare that has been very strong, especially in the past. And the fact that we have gotten over that and that we are out sailing now, and that we have gotten quite a far bit, is already a victory in itself. Of course, this mission includes many risks, and we have done many risk assessments. We deem the risk of silence and the risk of inaction to be so much more deadly than this mission, of course. And we are 12 peaceful volunteers who are not carrying weapons. We are carrying food, medical supplies, and sanitary products and other very needed humanitarian aid into Gaza following the blockade. We will meet whatever is thrown at us with nonviolence in any scenario. We are trying to prepare and to maximize our safety and the success of this mission as much as we can.
Greta, as you attempt to bring in baby formula, medical kits, flour, prosthetics for kids with amputations, the Israeli military has threatened to block the Freedom Flotilla. The Israeli army says it's prepared to raid your ship. We know what happened to the Mavi Marmara with the Israeli raid and the killing of 9 activists on board. Ultimately, a 10th died. So Are you seeing drones? How are you prepared to deal?
Yeah, we are seeing drones. Last night, there were two different moments where there were drones circulating above us. And we have safety procedures that we will use. And we have different scenarios that we are prepared for to try to maximize our safety in a non-violent way. So we are trying to do our very best. And it shows quite a bit that peaceful volunteers who are carrying humanitarian aid and necessary for survival is being threatened to be raided, intercepted, or attacked. I think that says quite a lot about the priorities and approaches of Israel right now. But we must also remember that this mission is not about us. It is not about the voyage or the people on board. This mission is about Palestine. It is about the genocide, the occupation, ethnic cleansing, and the other methods of war and oppression that are being used by Israel against the Palestinians. And we do not only need humanitarian aid to be let into Gaza. We do not only need a ceasefire. We need an end to the occupation.
Do you plan to break the military blockade around Gaza?
Sorry, what did you say?
How do you plan to break the military blockade around Gaza?
We are planning to continue sailing until we cannot sail anymore. It is very difficult to predict what scenario it will be, but as far as we know, we are planning to continue as we are now.
And what is your message to folks around the world, especially to young people who throughout the advanced countries seem to have much more interest and dedication to ending the war in Gaza?
My message is that right now, international law is failing us. International institutions, our governments are failing us. Media, our companies are all failing us. Or failing us is a diplomatic way of saying that our system seems to be designed in a way that is built upon exploitation and oppression of people. And so there's no one to turn to. There's no one we can turn to rescue the situation. But it falls on us to step up, to continue flooding the streets, to continue organizing, boycotting, to speak up on all platforms, to try to send a clear message that we will not stand for what is happening right now.
According to Al Jazeera, Greta, they're saying, according to flight radar, which tracks aircraft movements, an Israel-made Hellenic Coast Guard drone, IAI Heron UAV, hovered over the Madeleine ship. The drone's deployment was confirmed by the Greek Ministry of Defense. We're speaking to you from the United States, where the South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham wrote on X, "Hope Greta and her friends can swim." Your response?
We can swim very well. it says a lot about their priorities that in the face of genocide and systematic starvation of 2 million people, lawmakers, elected officials whose responsibility it should be to serve the people and to protect the people, that they, rather than ending their complicity in genocide and the mass slaughtering of civilians, are focusing on mocking people who are at least trying to do their bits. I think that says everything we need to know about their priorities.
And finally, your message to Palestinians who perhaps have read about or heard about your voyage or waiting your arrival, what is your message to them?
My message to them would be that we stand behind you in every step of the way. We are standing in solidarity with you. We see you. And I am also my deepest apologies on behalf of the outside world, especially the Western world, that we continue to betray you and that more people are not stepping up, but I promise that at least we here will try our very best to stand up for you and to support you in your struggle.
Greta, we wish you all safety. Greta Thunberg, internationally renowned Swedish climate activist who inspired the global youth climate strike. She's won the Right Livelihood Award, has also been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize, was speaking to us aboard the Gaza Freedom Flotilla's vessel Madeleine, which is on a voyage from Sicily to Gaza, carrying life-saving aid in an attempt to break Israel's siege of the Gaza Strip. It's day three of what they expect to be a seven-day trip. We'll continue to follow it. Next up is Republican lawmakers move to ban states from regulating artificial intelligence. We'll speak to the journalist Karen Hall, author of the new book Empire of AI, Dreams and Nightmares, and Sam Altman's Open AI. Stay with us.
Hola ila ila mama dara sulula igone bina kumasa leven sara la musula hadununya musula kola mongelema bekono ta segena kinulo segena hakigano la moho abada okata kala mola ibuti la mola kigano tono tu abada sa so para papa so so
Fatoumata Diawara. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to The Empire of AI. That's the name of a new book by the journalist Karen Hall, who's closely reported on the rise of the artificial intelligence industry with a focus on Sam Altman's OpenAI, the company behind ChatGPT. Karen Howe compares the actions of the AI industry to those of colonial powers in the past. She writes, quote, "The empires of AI are not engaged in the same overt violence and brutality that marked this history, but they, too, seize and extract precious resources to feed their vision of artificial intelligence. The work of artists and writers, the data of countless individuals posting about their experiences and observations online, the land, energy, and water required to house and run massive data centers and supercomputers," she writes. Karen Howe's book comes at a time when Republican Congress members are trying to block states from regulating AI. The House recently passed Trump's so-called Big Beautiful Budget Bill that contains a provision that would prohibit any state-level regulations of AI for the next decade, in a major gift to the AI industry. Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene has criticized the provision, even though she voted for the bill. She wrote online, quote, "Full transparency, I did not know about this section. I'm adamantly opposed to this, and it's a violation of state rights, and I would have voted no if I had known this was in there." She says she won't vote for it if it remains in there after the Senate votes. To talk about this and much more, we're joined by the journalist Karen Howe, whose new book, again, is just out, Empire of AI, Dreams and Nightmares, and Sam Altman's OpenAI, former reporter at The Wall Street Journal and MIT Technology Review. She leads the Pulitzer Center's AI Spotlight Series program for training journalists on how to cover AI. You should train everyone on how to understand AI, Karen. It's an amazing book.
Thank you so
why
much.
Don't you start by talking about the title, what exactly you mean, for a lay audience, for I suspect a lot of our audience are Luddites. So you really have to explain what artificial intelligence, artificial general intelligence is.
So AI is a collection of many different technologies, but most people were introduced to it through ChatGPT. And what I argue in the book and what the title refers to, Empire of AI, it's actually a critique of the specific trajectory of AI development that led us to ChatGPT and has continued since ChatGPT. And that is specifically Silicon Valley's scale at all costs approach to AI development. AI models in modern day, they are trained on data. They need computers to train them on that data. But what Silicon Valley did and what OpenAI did in the last few years is they started blowing up the amount of data and the size of the computers that need to do this training. So we are talking about the full English language internet being fed into these models, books, scientific articles, all of the intellectual property that is being created, and also massive supercomputers that run tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of computer chips that are the size of dozens, maybe hundreds of football fields, and use practically the entire energy demands of cities now. So this is an extraordinary type of AI development that is causing a lot of social labor and environmental harms. And that is ultimately why I evoke this analogy to empire.
And Karen, could you talk some more about not only the energy requirements, but the water requirements of these huge data centers that are in essence, the backbone of this widening industry?
Absolutely. I'll give you two stats on both the energy and the water. When talking about the energy demand, McKinsey recently came out with a report that said in the next 5 years, based on the current pace of AI computational infrastructure expansion, we would need to put as much energy on the global grid as what is consumed by 2 to 6 times the energy consumed annually by the state of California. And that will mostly be serviced by fossil fuels. We're already seeing reporting of coal plants with their lives being extended. They were supposed to retire, but now they cannot to support the data center development. We are seeing methane gas turbines, unlicensed ones, being popped up to service these data centers as well. From a fresh water perspective, these data centers need to be trained on fresh water. They cannot be trained on any other type of water because it can corrode the equipment, it can lead to bacterial growth, and most of the time, it actually taps directly into a public drinking water supply because that is the infrastructure that has been laid to deliver this clean, fresh water to different businesses, to different homes. And Bloomberg recently had an analysis where they looked at the expansion of these data centers around the world, and two-thirds of them are being placed in water-scarce areas. So they're being placed in communities that do not have access to fresh water. So it's not just the total amount of fresh water that we need to be concerned about, but actually the distribution of this infrastructure around the world.
And most people are familiar with ChatGPT, the consumer aspect of AI. But what about the military aspect of AI, where, in essence, we're finding Silicon Valley companies becoming the next generation of defense contractors?
One of the reasons why OpenAI and many other companies are turning to the defense industry is because they have spent an extraordinary amount of money in developing these technologies. They're spending hundreds of billions to train these models, and they need to recoup those costs. And there are only so many industries and so many places that have that size of a paycheck to pay. And so that's why we're seeing a cozying up to the defense industry. We're also seeing Silicon Valley use the U.S. government in their empire building ambitions. You could argue that the U.S. government is also trying to use Silicon Valley, vice versa, in their empire building ambitions. But certainly, these technologies are not designed to be used in a sensitive military context. And so the aggressive push of these companies to try and get those defense contracts and integrate their technologies more and more into the infrastructure of the military is really alarming.
I wanted to go to the countries you went to or the stories you covered. I mean, this is amazing, the depth of your reporting. From Kenya to Uruguay to Chile. You were talking about the use of water, and I also want to ask you about nuclear power. Yeah. But in Chile, what is happening there around these data centers and the water they would use and the resistance to that?
Yeah, so Chile has an interesting history in that it was under a dictatorship for a very long time. And so during that time, most public resources were privatized, including water. But because of an anomaly, there's one community in the Greater Santiago Metropolitan Region that actually still has access to a public freshwater resource that services both that community as well as the rest of the country in emergency situations. That is the exact community that Google chose to try to put a data center in. And they proposed for their data center to use 1,000 times more fresh water than that community used annually.
And it would be free.
And it, you know, I have no idea. That is a great question. But what the community told me was they weren't even paying taxes for this because they believed, based on reading the documentation, that the taxes that Google was paying was, in fact, to where they had registered their offices, their administrative offices, not where they were putting down the data center. So they were not seeing any benefit from this data center directly to that community. And they were seeing no checks placed on the fresh water that this data center would have been allowed to extract. And so these activists said, wait a minute. Absolutely not. We're not going to allow this data center to come in unless they give us a legitimate reason for why it benefits us. And so they started doing boots on the ground activism, pushing back, knocking on every single one of their neighbors' doors, handing out flyers to the community, telling them, this company is taking our freshwater resources without giving us anything in return. And so they escalated so dramatically that it escalated to Google Chile, it escalated to Google Mountain View, which, by the way, then sent representatives to Chile that only spoke English. But then it eventually escalated to the Chilean government. And the Chilean government now has roundtables where they ask these community residents and the company representatives and representatives from the government to come together to actually discuss how to make data center development more beneficial to the community. The activists say it is the fight is not over. Just because they've been invited to the table doesn't mean that everything is suddenly better. They need to stay vigilant. They need to continue scrutinizing these projects. But thus far, they've been able to block this project for 4 to 5 years and have gained that seat at the table.
And how is it that these Western companies, in essence, are exploiting labor in the global south? You go into something called data annotation firms. What are those?
Yeah, so because AI, modern day AI systems are trained on massive amounts of data and that's scraped from the internet, you can't actually pump that data directly into your AI model because there are a lot of things within that data. It's heavily polluted. It needs to be cleaned. It needs to be annotated. So this is where data annotation firms come in. These are middleman firms that hire contract labor to provide to these AI companies to do that kind of data preparation. And OpenAI, when it was starting to think about commercializing its products and thinking about, let's put text generation machines that can spew any kind of text into the hands of millions of users, they realized they needed to have some kind of content moderation. They needed to develop a filter that would wrap around these models and prevent these models from actually spewing racist, hateful, and harmful speech to users that would not make a very good commercially viable product. And so they contracted these middleman firms in Kenya, where the Kenyan workers had to read through reams of the worst text on the internet, as well as AI-generated text where OpenAI was prompting its own AI models to imagine the worst text on the internet, and then telling these Kenyan workers to categorize them in detailed taxonomies of, is this sexual content? Is this violent content? How graphic is that violent content? In order to teach its filter all the different categories of content it had to block. And this is an incredibly uncommon form of labor. There are lots of other different types of contract labor that they use. But these workers, they're paid a few bucks an hour, if at all. And just like the era of social media, these content moderators are left very deeply psychologically traumatized. And ultimately, there is no real philosophy behind why these workers are paid a couple bucks an hour and have their lives destroyed, and why AI researchers who also contribute to these models are paid million-dollar compensation packages simply because they sit in Silicon Valley in OpenAI's offices. That is the logic of empire, and that harkens back to my title, Empire of AI.
So let's go back to your title, Empire of AI, the subtitle, Dreams and Nightmares in Sam Altman's OpenAI. So tell us the story of Sam Altman and what OpenAI is all about, right through to the deal he just made in the Gulf when President Trump, Sam Altman and Elon Musk were there.
Altman is very much a product of Silicon Valley. His career was first as a founder of a startup and then as the president of Y Combinator, which is one of the most famous startup accelerators in Silicon Valley, and then the CEO of OpenAI. And there's no coincidence that OpenAI ended up introducing the world to the scale at all costs approach to AI development, because that is the way that Silicon Valley has operated in the entire time that Altman came up in it. And so he is a very strategic person. He is incredibly good at telling stories about the future and painting these sweeping visions that investors and employees want to be a part of. And so early on at YC, he identified that AI would be one of the trends that could take off. And he was trying to build a portfolio of different investments and different initiatives to place himself in the center of various different trends, depending on which one took off. He was investing in quantum computing, he was investing in nuclear fusion, he was investing in self-driving cars, and he was developing a fundamental AI research lab. Ultimately, the AI research lab was the ones that started accelerating really quickly, so he makes himself the CEO of that company. And originally, he started it as a nonprofit to try and position it as a counter to for-profit-driven incentives in Silicon Valley. But within 1.5 years, OpenAI's executives identified that if they wanted to be the lead in this space, they had to go for this scale-at-all-cost approach, and had to should be in quotes. They thought that they had to do this. There are actually many other ways to develop AI and to have progress in AI that does not take this approach. But once they decided that, they realized the bottleneck was capital. It just so happens Sam Altman is a once-in-a-generation fundraising talent. He created this new structure, nesting a for-profit arm within the nonprofit to become this fundraising vehicle for the tens of billions and ultimately hundreds of billions that they needed to pursue the approach that they decided on. And that is how we ultimately get to present-day OpenAI, which is one of the most capitalistic companies in the history of Silicon Valley, continuing to raise hundreds of billions, and Altman has joked even trillions, to produce a technology that ultimately has a middling economic impact thus far.
And we only have about a minute left, but the relationship between Altman and other rivals like Google or Elon Musk?
It is accelerating the development of this technology that, again, I mentioned has this middling impact. We've seen through the history of OpenAI that all of the former executives that have left have created their own rivals. So Elon Musk was one of the original co-founders, created XAI. Ilya Sutskever was the chief scientist, created Safe Superintelligence. Mira Murati was the former chief technology officer, created Thinking Machines Lab. All of them are now competing to try and dominate this technology and try and make it in their own image.
And finally, this regulation within the so-called Big Beautiful Bill that says AI can't be regulated by states for a decade?
This is absolutely going to enshrine the impunity of Silicon Valley into law. I mean, I call these empires of AI because they are already quickly becoming the apex predator in the ecosystem, able to act in their self-interest. And that bill, if passed, would certainly codify that.
Well, we're going to do a part two posted online at democracynow.org. Karen Howe is author of Empire of AI, Dreams and Nightmares, and Sam Altman's OpenAI. Tune in tomorrow on Democracy Now! When we speak with the British journalist Carol Cadwallader about how to survive the broligarchy. We've got three job openings, senior headline news producer, a director of audience, and a director of technology, all full-time here in New York. You can learn more at democracynow.org/jobs. Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terrasana, Tammy Wuerff, Shireen Inandura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!